I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second probably is a revolutionary moment.
The rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Creative Futurism. I'm John Best.
And I am Kevin J. Anderson. And this podcast is all about changes in technology and business and creativity and especially unintended consequences, because you never know where you're going to get caught from left field. So we've always got many things to talk about. We don't even have a beer in front of us this time.
So. Yeah. Well, I want to start with this. So first of all, as a noted Star Wars author, I got to think that you're excited about the new Solo movie. I know I am.
And as we record this, it opens on Thursday night. And yes, indeed, I have Rebecca, my wife, and I, both Star Wars authors. We have tickets for the opening show. There's a 6:30 Colorado Springs show where there's a bunch of Star Wars fans getting together for like a movie camp. And we're going to be there and having a blast. We saw Last Jedi on opening night. We're seeing Solo on opening night. And I can just enjoy that because I still haven't gotten around to seeing Avengers Infinity War, because I just don't have 3 hours to kill. That's what's scaring me on that one.
Three, it is a long, I did see it, but that's really wild that you haven't seen it. I would have thought that, especially after our last episode where we talked about it. I mean, I got to say, I really enjoyed it. It is a lot of characters, you know, you start to realize how many characters are in this universe, and they're all played by these just heavy hitter, incredible actors. So when do you think you'll get time to see it, or are you just giving up?
Probably on Redbox. That's how I usually see a lot of things. I did see Black Panther in the theater, though. I saw it at Hollywood Boulevard and Man's Chinese Theater. So that was
you saw it at the Chinese Grauman Theater.
Yeah,
right? Cool.
Well, it's now Man's Chinese
Theater. Oh, is it Man's? Last time I was there, it was Grauman.
That's where we saw it. So that was kind of a bucket list thing. So my head is full of superheroes at the moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of superheroes in that one. Speaking of being a superhero, you are a superhero author who is continuously turning in new books. Every time I talk to you, you're like, oh, I'm just finishing this chapter, and you jump from fantasy dragons to this amazing other stuff. So tell me what you're delivering recently. Like, what are we putting out this week?
Well, that's the reason why I haven't seen Avengers Infinity War, is that I just finished the seventh draft, which I delivered to my editor at Tor Books, of Spine of the Dragon, which was 810 pages long, but I cut it down to a mere 698 pages. So it's very heavily edited, rewritten, revised, and it's ready to go. Spine of the Dragon, it's a giant, like Game of Thrones, epic fantasy. So that's what I did last week. And at the same time, or just before that, we delivered a final manuscript of my high-tech nuclear waste storage thriller with Doug Beeson, and Doug has been on the show. We talked about it. It was called The Doomsday Cascade, but one of the busy things we did in the just past week or so is we worked really hard and with our editor and with other readers, and we got the title changed. It will now be called Critical Mass. So that's, I guess you get bigger letters on the cover or something. So Critical Mass, high-tech people trapped in a nuclear waste storage. And ironically, that's how I really got to know our next guest who's going to be on the show with us today, because my editor on The Doomsday Cascade or Critical Mass is Bob Gleason. And I've actually known Bob for 20-some years. He's been an editor for a very long time, primarily on big thrillers and high-tech things. But he also happens to be a highly regarded expert in nuclear terrorism. And he's published numerous books on the subject, both fiction and nonfiction, including the book cleverly titled The Nuclear Terrorist, subtitled Nuclear Terrorist, His Financial Backers and Political Patrons in the U.S. and Abroad. And his most recent novel is The Evil That Men Do. And his other books include And Into the Fire, End of Days, and Wrath of God. Bob has spoken about nuclear terrorism at Harvard. He's been on the Sean Hannity and the Lou Dobbs shows. He's been on NPR, and he starred in a History Channel special on the subject called Prophets of Doom. So in addition to being an editor, he kind of knows his stuff about nuclear terrorism. So now that we've talked a lot, Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Kevin.
That sounds like very light fare that you're writing. Was it The Wrath of God, The End Evil That Men Do? What's that?
End of Days.
Yeah, those are all, I like these. These are very uplifting titles. Well, welcome, Bob. Thanks for coming on.
So why don't you tell us why we shouldn't sleep well at night, Bob? Because it sounds like you found practically every terrifying scenario that things could go wrong and destroy the world. So what do we most have to worry about?
Well, I think one of the problems that's not getting enough attention is the movement of the, not only in the United States, but around the world, that the democracies of the world are increasingly turning into oligarchies. And it's been pointed out, Louis Brandeis pointed out about 80 years ago, he said you can have money and power concentrated in a few hands, which is oligarchy, or you can have democracy. You can't have both. That the Aristotle said 2,500 years ago, so did Plato, that you, when you have extremes of wealth, you know, great wealth and not a thriving middle class, no thriving middle class, that it's almost impossible to have democracy. So that spells the death of democracy. And right now in the United States, we've got three men who have more money than 50% of the country's population. Globally, there's 8 men, 6 of them Americans, who have more money than 50% of the planet's population.
Wow.
The planet has the world's GDP is $75 trillion. There's approximately $26 trillion in offshore black hole tax havens. That's a third of the world's GDP. In the case of Russia, Putin and his oligarchs have stolen over 100% of Russia's GDP. They have stolen, let me repeat, they've stolen over 100% of Russia's GDP put it in offshore black hole accounts. They have so plundered that country that a Russian male lives 11 years fewer than 11 fewer years than a Russian woman. A Russian boy has a lower life expectancy than a young boy in Haiti. They have just plundered. Putin and his cronies have plundered that country piecemeal. And in and it's played havoc with the population. In 35 years, the working class population of Russia is going to be 14% of the total population. 14% of the population will be supporting the other 86%. That's because the life expectancy among the men is so low. Putin's pretty much, and you could see one of the reasons he's stealing so much money and hiding it overseas is there's not going to be much of a country left by the time he reaches the end of his life. He wants to get, you know, he wants to get that money out of there before the whole country collapses.
So, yeah, I mean, I was actually doing some research into Putin lately just because I realized that at the time I was in, you don't know much about me, Bob, but I grew up in Germany. So I was there when Chernobyl went off and, you know, I never knew a Europe without a wall, you know, so I've been back since. But and it was interesting to figure out kind of, you know, how he came to power in the sense of the nationalism, the fact he just, I guess, put a hand on, was it Gorbachev, and said, yeah, you're done now, or the guy after him. And boom, he was next day in power. It's been pretty phenomenal to see how that all comes together. The question I have is, you know, how long before the country, you know, sort of realizes these things that you're speaking of, these facts, and how can they, or is there just no way out in that sort of leadership and the kind of mechanism he's put in place?
Well, it's a, you know, you can divide the world up into givers and takers. Approximately, you know, half the world is givers. The other half, that they're, you know, that they're takers. When they make a mistake, they don't accept responsibility for it. They blame other people. So about half of, and it's the tragic flaw of democracies, about half of the electorate will not vote their own self-interest. They vote their grievances. And the thing about Putin is that he's really been able to turn Russia into a culture of grievance. When you look at the actual economic statistics, that under Yeltsin, who was unpopular, that they had a surprising amount of freedom. They had a real democracy with actual elections. And if you look at the economic statistics, that Russia was a lot more prosperous than it is under Putin. Nonetheless, Putin's been able to, a lot of the people in Russia, they vote their grievances. And he's been able to convince them that the whole world is encircling them, that they're under siege, the West in particular is besieging them, and that the only thing standing between the Russian people and the everlasting night is Vladimir Putin. And you know, they because it's a culture that goes around blaming everybody else for their problems, and he's popular. They see him as a knight in shining armor, when in fact he and his cronies have stolen the entire GDP of that country.
So it's a culture of victims looking for a savior. I was reading this quote from Ward Larson, and Kevin, you didn't tell me that we could be putting our life in danger. I'm a little upset here. He said, Ward Larson predicts, were I Gleason, I'd be checking my beer for the pungent tang of polonium-210 for the rest of my life. So now we can't have any beers, thanks to you, Kevin.
Yeah, where are you going to find the polonium anyway? They're rat poison is a lot easier to get your hands on. So.
Well, it's only polonium's only manufactured in one country. That's Russia. So and it's become so closely identified with Putin, he seems reluctant to use it anymore. He has, however, a gigantic arsenal of all kinds of exotic poisons. One of them comes from a flower that only exists along the snow line in the upper Himalayas. He's now killing people with nerve gas, which kills, you know, everybody that's within that comes near it. It's a weapon of mass murder. That's how ruthless he is. He's happy to use nerve gas. If he wants to eliminate somebody, he'll use nerve gas on him, even if it kills everybody in the room with the guy.
Wow. This is fascinating and horrifying stuff. I mean, the statistics that you're talking about are, I've never heard any of those statistics about the Russian man being fifth, life expectancy being so low. And I mean, it looks to me like we're going to have some Armageddon turmoil coming out in 15, 20 years, just as a consequence to that. And I think China is facing a similar crisis with their population and the aging of their population too. But is to get to more the subject of the nuclear terrorism part. So is Russia likely to be the most frightening source of potential nuclear terrorism? Or, I mean, we all think about ISIS or Iran being the primary problems. Is that, who do we most have to worry about?
Well, by the way, before I forget, let me mention my website. It's www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is spelled G-L-E-A-S-O-N. That's robertgleasonbooks.com. I'm always most concerned about the enemy within. I mentioned that, you know, the United States is with three people. The United States have more money than 50% of the population. That also 50% of all non-farm corporate profit in the United States is sucked up by Wall Street. Back 100 years ago, we had some very tough, very ruthless robber barons, you know, John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Frick Harriman, Henry Ford. But they were also great men. They really industrialized America. And they created the gasoline that Rockefeller refined, the gasoline that powered the Industrial Revolution. The Ford, you know, made automobiles available to almost everybody in the country. Carnegie, you know, created the steel that built all this stuff. Frickin' Harriman, the railroads. These are great men. You go through the Forbes American richest American lists now, you see an awful lot of them are hedge fund managers. That hedge funds are based on global derivative debt. Global derivative debt, it's pure, uncollateralized, intrinsic debt. And there's now $1.4 quadrillion, quadrillion in global derivative debt. And to say that's not a bubble, and it's because it's uncollateralized, to say that's not a bubble and that's not going to explode is just foolish. You know, we had a derivative debt bubble burst in 2008. It will happen. And as I said, that now 50% of all non-farm corporate profit in America is being sucked up by these guys are taking more money from us than the IRS. Pretty much taking more money from corporations. That's the enemy we really have to fear. Now, that there's a couple of theories on how democracies die. There is a book out called, a pretty good book called How Democracies Die, that argue that the old coup d'etats, like the Putin staged a coup d'etat in Russia when in 1999 he blew up complexes of apartment buildings in three Russian cities. He tried to do it in a fourth. He had the what used to be the KGB, now the FSB, blow them up. We caught guys doing it. They caught guys doing it.
Yeah, because they were saying that it was, they were trying to say it was what, Ukrainian Muslim terrorists or whatnot.
Chechnyan. They said it was Chechnyan separatists.
Chechnyan separatists.
And in fact, that Putin used that as an excuse to pass dictatorial powers. General Tommy Frank said that he was afraid if we ever had a nuclear 9/11, that the Congress and the American people would willingly surrender its authority to a despotic tyrant who would, thinking that the despot would somehow offer them more security than democracy.
Yeah, it's the hero fantasy,
and,
right?
But these guys that wrote How Democracies Die, they said there's another scenario, and that's where a demagogue uses the very institutions of democracy to subvert the democracy and so weaken and debilitate those checks and balances that they cease to exist. And that despot ends up with dictatorial power. And they give examples where that's happened, Venezuela, other places. You could see that with the passage of the Patriot Act, that Bush was trying to solidify all his powers. And one of the things that you have to do to, that a demagogue has to do to accomplish that is, he has to have a takeover of the media. And you can see that how polarized and partisan the media has become, that when Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, that it basically created what amounts to state TV, where we have TV networks now that are just mouthpieces for the current administration.
This is all sounding very familiar, and I'm kind of curled up into a fetal position right now, but I can still reach the microphone.
So just real quick, what I think what you're saying is, there used to be that the thought process was democracies would die from a heart attack, some flash event, right? Now what you're saying is they can sort of die of pneumonia, you know, this slow eating up of, you know, for example, just recently, there's so many things on Trump, but there was this one thing that sort of came out that said, hey, you did this. And if it had been any other time, it would have been headline news on every single page. But because it's created such a large variety of issues, it's lost in the ether of everything else that's going on, which is kind of that pneumonia. So that, like, hey, none of this stuff really matters. If I say it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. And so then it becomes an opportunity for him to consolidate power.
Well, if you look at how a lot of the democracies, republics in the past died, that if you look at the Roman Republic, for instance, under Caesar Augustus, it had had nonstop unrest, conflict, turmoil. And finally, the Senate willingly handed authority over to Caesar Augustus, institutionalizing the tyranny of Julius Caesar. After the French Revolution, there was nonstop unrest, nonstop civil conflict, and finally the French legislature handed over the reins of power to Napoleon, so he could put it down. The same thing happened to Kerensky's. Russia had a kind of monarchical democracy, and there was so much civil unrest that the Bolsheviks were able to take power quite easily. The same thing with Hitler and the Weimar Republic. One of the things Putin has tried to do in our election, and you can see a lot of the extreme partisan politicians tried to do, is they want to foment unrest. They want to foment, get people fighting with each other. The point of so many of those Russian ads in the last election were to make people hate each other. When that happens, when people are in constant conflict and extreme partisanship, the institutions of democracy are paralyzed. And people become very frustrated with democracy. And they start to think that it can't do anything. And that they start to long for the strong man. The Toynbee in A Study of History said that one of the first signs that a civilization is starting to collapse is when the people yearn for a strong man, want to give up all their freedom and all their power to a strong man who will take over and make things right and fix everything. And of course, that almost never happens. And instead, you end up with a tyrant. People get so frustrated with democracy, and you know, they just think it doesn't work. And as Tommy Frank said, a really scary scenario for that is what happens if there are a couple of cities get nuked. That is something that is utterly beyond bearing. It's all the horrors of Revelation locked up into one. And you know, in Revelation, one of the ways that God destroys humankind is he hurls stars down onto the earth. And what is a nuclear weapon except a miniature man-made star detonating on the earth? And it is so beyond bearing. You can imagine the United States surrendering up its the institutions, surrendering their authority to somebody like a Donald Trump or George W. Bush.
Well, and you said earlier about how people vote their grievances rather than in their own interest. And we have been seeing that people get so ginned up and so upset about something, they will vote without realizing that they're like cutting their own legs off at the knees.
Yeah, most people don't want to take responsibility for their own actions. They want to blame other people for everything. Somebody's to blame. People like that will definitely vote their grievances. One of the criticisms, by the way, of today's oligarchs is the Harvard Business Review has been very keen on this. They don't, you know, Romney said that they were job creators. It pointed out they're not job creators at all. They don't do a lot of R&D, research and development, in these corporations anymore. They get we have most of the big industries in the United States are oligopolies, which means that there's fewer than a half dozen major companies dominating, say, the drug industry, the financial industry, the media, the news media. And so consequently, there's not that much competition. And one of the side effects of all this is you can pretty much set your own prices when there's not that much competition. So instead of putting money into marketing, putting money into research and development, creating more products, instead, they engage in stock buybacks. They lavish incredible sums of money on the CEOs, the board members, the high-priced executives, that they use these gigantic transnational corporations, the CEOs use them as their personal piggy banks. The wages stagnate because in many parts of the country, the employees, they don't have a lot of jobs to choose from. And you end up having to take whatever you get and whatever wages you can get.
So you're saying trickle down doesn't work?
Oh, no, absolutely never worked. David Stockman, who was Reagan's budget director, he did an interview in, I believe it was 84, with William Grider, in which he said to him, he said, everybody knew in the administration, the Reagan administration, supply side economics was a bad joke. Everybody knew it didn't work. And he said, this is an exact quote, Stockman said to Grider, supply side economics was always the Trojan horse for upper bracket tax cuts. It's just a ruse by which you can line the pockets of the rich. And believe me, the politicians all realize that. There's now 200 billionaire donors in the country that donate more money to the Republican Party at state, local, and federal levels than all other campaign contributors put together. Now, you tell me those 200 billionaires, many of whom are lining up behind the Koch brothers, you tell me that they're not getting what they pay for.
I think they realized that. What was it? There were six corporations in the first quarter of the year that alone were able to save literally in the billions. And then they turned that right around and turned it into donations into the GOP.
Yeah, and they turned it into tax law. What do you think the new budget is? It's just a giveaway to billionaires.
So I want to keep on this nuclear thing. So you're talking about like Donald Trump, Michael Flynn. Do you think, and you said earlier, I'm always worried about the enemy within. And so, and I could just tell, I can hear it in your voice, the concern here. Michael Flynn, and I feel like there's a lot of information that you have around this. I'm interested.
Oh, by the way, the title of the book is The Evil That Men Do. It's from Julius Caesar, of course. Well, Flynn has been trying to sell, he was caught trying to sell 44 nuclear power plants to Saudi Arabia and its Arab allies. Now, the problem, one of the many problems with nuclear power is it's fantastically expensive. The most expensive machine on the face of the earth is the Sheffield, England nuclear power plant. It's cost over $35 billion. The only more expensive machine, as Doug will know, is the International Space Station, which cost $150 billion, but that's in outer space. But also, you know, nobody, Doug Beeson also know, nobody's ever figured out what to do with the nuclear waste. There's over 300,000 metric tons of it worldwide. Nobody knows what to do with it. And so this is a stupid idea whose time never should have come. We really should abolish nuclear power. Let all the existing plants phase out. Do not renew any more licenses and go on to other things. Among other things, one of the many reasons though why it's dangerous is that it's often been said that nuclear power is training wheels and a starter kit for nuclear weapons programs. So it's horribly dangerous when you sell nuclear power plants to these unstable nations. What Michael Flynn was really attempting to do is genuinely evil. And the kind of greed that generates this kind of thinking and the kind of destructiveness is really apocalyptic. It really is the stuff of Revelation.
It's sounding to me like Michael Bay should make Revelations as his next big budget movie. With nuclear terrorism, everybody thinks about somebody smuggling an actual nuclear weapon that will blow up, which is a whole lot harder to do than just a dirty bomb, which has a bunch of radioactive waste in it, radioactive material that you blow up something that's just powdered radioactive waste in downtown Manhattan. You've got the entire country that's in an utter panic because everybody's terrified of radiation. Can you talk a little bit about the chances of somebody getting an actual detonatable nuclear warhead smuggled into the country as opposed to just a dirty bomb?
Well, I personally, I've done a lot of research on dirty bombs, and I think the general consensus is that their destructive power has been oversold. That most of the studies on the so-called dirty bomb indicate that the lion's share of the fatalities and casualties would actually come from the conventional explosive in the dirty bomb. In that book, How Democracies Die, that the authors argued that when you have a two-party democracy, which we have in the United States, we have a Republican Party, a Democrat, those are the parties that determine, you know, that, well, one of those is going to win almost all the elections. One of those, somebody from one of those two parties. But in order to have that democracy work, if you get a really, really bad candidate, that people in the other party, a significant number of them, are going to have to say, I'm going to cross party lines, vote for the opposite party, because our guy is really bad. And also at the same time, the members of that, let's say the GOP, let's say Trump is really a horrible president. What you have to do is you have to have Republicans, a lot of Republican voters are going to say, I'm going to vote against Trump. I'm going to vote for Hillary. And then also you have to have politicians in the Republican Party, if they really don't like Trump, they have to be willing to say publicly, vote for Hillary. Don't vote for Trump. They have to come out and say that. To say don't vote or to say vote for an independent candidate, that's essentially a vote for the candidate you don't like. Now, take a look at that Alabama election. We had a guy that there were very, very serious charges, many serious charges, that the guy was a pederast and the guy running for the Senate. And 50% of Alabamans said, I would rather have a pederast in office than a Democrat. There was that guy down in West Virginia. He was convicted for as when he was running the coal
mine explosion,
having killed a bunch of coal miners. He was convicted of murder. And there were a lot of people in West Virginia said, I'd rather have a murderer in office than a Democrat. When you get that degree of partisanship where people think the other party is actually more dangerous than pederasts and murderers, then democracy's dead.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is that the whole point of the election hacking was to foment this sort of polarization, so that, because I was reading this article about conspiracy theories, and they were saying that conspiracy theories are constructed in order to help the human mind cope with a fear that they have. So, for example, JFK, right? So can one guy really mess up the whole world? That can't be true. It must be that there was a complicated conspiracy by the government, and this makes me feel better because I can't have this whole one guy being able to sort of, mess up everything. But in this particular model, the idea is to create enough doubt and amongst our news organizations, basically the third, or the fourth estate, to get them to sort of just walk away from everything, and then all at the same time turn like you said, people who were non-voters against one into another. So rather than promote your candidate, you demonize the other. Is that kind of the mentality?
Yeah. Also, the William Manchester's three-volume biography of Churchill, he goes into the British aristocracy. We now, because the government was run by actual aristocrats, and we refer to them as appeasers. That Manchester points out, they did more than appease Hitler. That they did, they actually supported him financially. They did a lot of financial business with Hitler. And they were really enriching the Nazi party and the Nazi government. And he says at the end of the second volume, the reason they did it was that the British aristocracy hated labor unions. They hated things like so, and because the labor unions are fighting for Social Security, universal health care, they're fighting for unemployment insurance, things like that. And the British aristocracy hated that. They said, that's our money they're trying to take. They're trying to put our money into Social Security programs, that sort of thing. And Hitler had completely crushed the labor unions in Germany. They liked Hitler. And in fact, there's a scene in The Arms of Krupp where the German industrialists all get around. They decide whether or not they're going to support Hitler. And they know all about him. They know Mein Kampf. They know he's an anti-Semite. They know he's violent, all that. But he tells them, you will have no more union problems in the Third Reich. And they love that. That's music to their ears. They forget all their qualms, all their reservations about Hitler. They throw their money at him with both hands and both feet, welcome him with open arms. And that's one of the dangers of oligarchy. It really, once you get oligarchy, you have endless civil unrest. You've got anger. And of course the oligarchs, they want increase. They don't want Social Security. They don't want Medicare. They want that money belongs to them. That's their view of it. And so then you get endless unrest. So a lot of these problems in the end do come back to the money. One of the reasons Hitler was successful was that the British aristocracy and the French aristocracy thought, Hitler will help us make more money.
I'm curled up in the ball now. Now I'm shaking. So I'm going to throw this at you, Kevin. This has been a fantastic interview. I'd like to have Bob back on. This is, really spectacular stuff.
By the way, the book title is The Evil That Men Do. My website is www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is Gleason.
I've known Bob because he edited our Doomsday Cascade or Critical Mass manuscript, and very insightful questions, comments, well beyond an editor saying, pump up the characterization here. You were really into the the technical details as well. And I've also, you've often sent me copies, pre-release copies of books that you're working on that you thought I would be interested in. So we'll plug that again. He's got more of what we've been talking about today in a book called The Nuclear Terrorist, and his novels, The Evil That Men Do and Into the Fire, End of Days, Wrath of God, plenty of stuff. Anyway, well, thank you, Bob, so much for some fascinating stuff, and it'll give me and John a lot of things to be chewing on, and I hope our listeners as well. So this will wrap up a current edition of creativefuturism.com, and we will sign off. This is Kevin J. Anderson.
John Best.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.